operational expenses for organizations' programs.
According to the United Nations, Yemenis are experiencing the world's worst humanitarian crisis since the beginning of 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a devastating war on the impoverished country.
Yemenis say the UN campaigns and initiatives are useless unless they are associated with real steps to stop the ongoing war and the blockade on Yemen that have led to the death of tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, and is still going on. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنع.
Britain, France and Germany drop a resolution against Iran at the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said most board members agreed that now is not the time for a resolution criticizing Iran's cooperation with the agency. Tehran had warned the three European states the adoption of such a resolution would be interpreted as an end to the joint understanding between Iran and the IAEA reached more than a week ago, allowing the agency to continue with necessary verification work in the country. Gharibabadi said the E3 exercised a prudent approach by considering the consequences of their proposal.
We welcome such an approach by the Board of Governors and also the E3 countries, and it shows that the wisdom prevails, actually. And in my view, by stopping the process of pursuing this resolution, an unnecessary tension was prevented.
IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi said Tehran had accepted his initiative to engage in a focused, systematic effort to clarify a number of outstanding issues.
We were able to have an understanding, and we are going to be starting this process of focused analysis of the situation with a technical meeting, which will take place in Iran the beginning of April, which I hope will be followed by other technical or political meetings as agreed by both sides.
Grossi said his intention is to come to a satisfactory outcome in time for the next regular session of the board next June. The agency says it wants to clarify questions concerning the presence of uranium particles at undeclared locations in Iran. Iran has already provided the agency with complementary access to three locations. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA says Tehran is also determined to resolve the remaining issues, although it does not believe in setting artificial deadlines. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Preliminary data released by the National Bureau of Statistics ISTAT shows that absolute poverty levels in Italy reached a 15-year high in 2020. Last year, the number of families facing absolute poverty climbed to 7.7% from 6.4% in 2019, translating into more than 2 million households not being able to afford the minimum standards of living, which include food, adequate shelter, and healthcare.
We had more than 1 million additional poor in 2020 compared to the year before. However, it must be said that growing poverty levels have also been recorded across all European countries and in the UK after the 2008 financial crisis. Italy has struggled to pick up from that downturn due to a fragmentation of anti-poverty policies and ineffective employment strategies.
Statistical body ISTAT also stressed that the monthly spending of the average Italian household dropped by almost 10%. Sent to about €2,300 last year, the lowest value since 2000.
Those without solid job contracts are the most exposed in the COVID-19 crisis that has already killed almost 100,000 people in Italy, the second highest death toll in Europe. Food security is emerging as a key issue for an increasing number of Italians.
The cost of living has risen to unbearable levels. My son used to work as a temporary employee in a restaurant. He has been jobless for months now. How long can we carry on this way?
The previous government hasn't helped Italy much. My daughter has been temporarily laid off.
and our pay is now one-third of what it used to be.
Discontent among Italians is also growing over a much-delayed vaccination campaign. So far, 1.5 million people, about 3% of the population only, have been inoculated with both COVID vaccine doses amid delays and disputes in the delivery schedule across the whole of the European Union. Max Civili, Rome.
Presidents of 17 universities from 10 member states of the Economic Cooperation Organization attended the online session to exchange views on ways to expand scientific cooperation. Hosted by Iran's Allama Tabatabai University, the event was attended by university heads from Pakistan, Turkey, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan.
I would like to express my gratitude for the invitation to such an important event. At the Kyrgyz-Russian Slavic University, there are 9,000 students, 7 faculties, and 92 departments. Out of this number, over 1,600 are international students coming from 19 countries, including from ECO member states.
We have a lot of potential. We have a lot of opportunities to collaborate with each other. How we can collaborate? There is a faculty exchange program. We can collaborate in terms of faculty exchange, in terms of student exchange.
Allama Tabatabai University, which hosted the session, was founded in 1984 with two departments of literature and humanities and administrative and commercial sciences. The ATU then expanded its academic activities by launching more departments, such as Persian literature and foreign languages, social sciences, economics, accounting and management, psychology and educational sciences, and health and basic sciences. Its incumbent president, Hossein Salimi, says the ATU has enormous potential for cooperation with other ECO member states.
We will start with exchanging professors and students and cooperation in research projects and common educational and major project, and I think that we can start with some workshops and some seminars between universities.
Launched in 1985 by Iran, Pakistan, and Turkey with the purpose of promoting economic and technical cooperation, the ECO is an intergovernmental organization which encompasses countries from Europe and Asia, covering a population of 460 million people. The overall objective of the organization is to promote sustainable economic development of its member states and the region. Currently, the regional organization has 10 member states, including Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Azerbaijan.
The ECO was established as a network that connects the economies of the member states. However, delegates here say it can act as more than just an economic link, but as a platform for scientific and technological exchanges. They say today's session was a promising start to that end. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
COVID-19 has compounded a problem that was already prevalent in the 27-nation European Union. Poverty affects a quarter of the bloc's citizens in one form or another. The so-called European Pillar of Social Rights Action Plan has just been presented.
Our first aim is to combat child poverty. Too many children in Europe are exposed to the risk of poverty.
A key element of the European Commission's plan is to modernise the EU's education systems. The aim is to lift 15 million people in the EU out of poverty by 2030. Similar targets were missed in the past.
I think the European Commission has been putting forward some interesting proposal to reduce unemployment, but I don't think it goes far enough. I think more needs to be done really to put job creation at the heart of the policy process.
The coronavirus has led to a surge in mental health issues in the EU due to lockdowns and rising unemployment, but unions say the psychological impact is also hitting those still in work. Calls are being made on the European Commission to develop a strategy to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder that could affect many of the bloc's 14.7 million frontline health workers, particularly those who have been administering care in the coronavirus hotspots. Experts say the EU's slow vaccination vaccination rollout is allowing mutations of the virus to spread. The European Commission has been asked to respond.
These new variants, where we definitely need to adapt, adjust, prepare, and front-load many of the efforts we have planned.
At this point, it's impossible to say precisely how many people in the EU have been vaccinated.
I have called on member states to increase information on sharing on national vaccination rollout plans and share this data.
The European Commission has announced it will present plans focusing on the easing of COVID-19 restrictions on the 17th of this month. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Jubilations among ranks and files of the opposition parties after the Senate elections in Pakistan. The combined opposition parties have managed to retain its majority in 100-member Senate. The Senate elections were held against 37 seats, and the ruling party of Prime Minister Imran Khan 125 seats. Khan's party emerged as the single largest political force in the Senate for the first time. Nonetheless, Khan's party, together with its allies, is still short of six senators to gain majority in the Senate. Under the proportionate election systems, four provincial parliaments, together with the national parliament, elect 100-member Senate. After every 3 years, half of the senators retire, and regional and federal parliaments elect remaining members of the upper house of the parliament through secret balloting. Despite emerging as the single largest political force in the Senate elections, Khan's party suffered a major setback when the 342-member lower house of the parliament elected opposition candidate Yousaf Rza Gilani as the senator. Gilani is also the former prime minister of Pakistan. With the election of Gilani, the opposition is now eyeing at dislodging the Prime Minister. The opposition says Khan has lost majority in the National Assembly, which had elected him Prime Minister in 2018.
Now Prime Minister Imran Khan must resign. It is not only a demand by the opposition, but Senate pattern indicates that it is also demand of members of the ruling party.
Opposition candidate won the elections amid a video scandal on mainstream media showing agent of opposition offering tens of millions of dollars to win over MPs of the ruling party.
Opposition must feel ashamed of what they are talking about. The video shows selling votes to the opposition, which back up our stance against corruption.
Under pressure from the opposition parties, the government has announced that Prime Minister Imran Khan would soon take a fresh vote of confidence from the National Assembly. Analysts say that Khan is likely to retain his majority in the lower house of the parliament. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015, hoping to bring former President Abdul Rabbu Mansur Hadi, who had resigned and fled the country, back to power. But with nearly 6 years into the war, Saudi Arabia has achieved none of its goals, and the war has left no choice for Yemenis but to resist. In the latest development, the Yemeni army launched a missile attack against an Aramco oil facility in Saudi Arabia's Jeddah on Thursday. The army also said it had successfully hit the King Khalid Airbase in the kingdom's Asir province using drones. The attacks come in reaction to Saudi Arabia's ongoing war, despite Washington's pledge to end it. U.S. President Joe Biden ordered to halt arms sales to the kingdom to stop them being used in Yemen. However, Biden pledged to continue supporting Riyadh to defend its sovereignty. Analysts say the U.S. continues to transfer arms to Saudi Arabia under the pretext of selling defensive weapons.
When Joe Biden stated that he was not going to sell offensive missiles and weaponry to Saudi Arabia, that is what we call gobbledygook, because a weapon can be both defensive and offensive.
Besides, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson defended his country's continued arms sales to Saudi Arabia. He also stood by his government's decision to cut aid to war-torn Yemen by half, citing economic strains from the coronavirus pandemic. Yemen says the humanitarian situation resulted from the Saudi blockade has even become worse after Biden took office.
Actually, since Biden has took office, Saudi has blocked all ships that come in from Hodeidah, especially oil tanker. And this is actually has not happened during Trump administration.
The UN had appealed for $3.85 billion to fund urgently needed humanitarian programs in Yemen, but only $1.7 billion was offered at this year's donor conference. The UN described the pledges as disappointing and stressed that cutting aid would mean a death sentence for Yemeni people. Yemen relies on imports that have been badly disrupted over the years by the Saudi-led war and blockade. According to the World Body, the war on Yemen has created the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. A recent report showed some 16 million Yemenis, or more than half the population, is going hungry. Of those, 5 million are on the brink of famine. The UN stressed that the only solution to end the crisis in Yemen is ceasefire and a political solution. But considering the current stance by the West toward Yemen, it seems the US and its allies do not want the war to stop anytime soon.
In a press conference held in Yemeni capital of Sana'a, the country's Ministry of Water and Environment elaborated on the damage inflicted to the water resources and infrastructure due to the Saudi-led invasion since 2015. The ministry said the war has impacted the sector severely, depriving thousands of Yemenis of access to drinking water. Officials said the war and siege imposed on the country have heavily affected the water supplies and forced millions to use unhealthy ways to store water. However, they say the severe fuel crisis has a major role in water shortage.
The per capita daily share of water consumption has dropped to 35 liters, and the lack of fuel will cause further decline and make matters worse. Water treatment and sanitation are also directly linked to fuel, so lack of fuel and the interruption in these processes may cause epidemics and endanger millions of lives.
Water resources and infrastructure are among the vital sectors that have been targeted by the Saudi-imposed war on Yemen. The war has left millions of Yemeni people without access to food and water, causing what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Thousands of Yemenis, including women and children, died of cholera during the 6 years of war. However, the Yemeni struggle to reach clean drinking water continues. The coronavirus pandemic has also worsened the situation in a country where more than 80% of people are in need of humanitarian assistance and support. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Israeli regime approved the building of 930 settlement units in the illegal settlement of Beis Gad Ze'ev in the heart of occupied Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Anti-settlement groups said the new units will be established on land seized from the villages of Beit Hanina, Hizma and Anata, northeast Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Israeli media quoted the Israeli mayor of Al-Quds, Moshe Lion, saying the new units are part of a plan amounting to 400 million shekels, around $122 million, to expand and support the settlements of Ramat Shlomo, Gilo, and Givat Hamatis, north and south the city.
This is targeting the Palestinian communities inside Jerusalem, Beit Hanina, Anata, and Hizma. It's a neighborhood, Palestinian neighborhood in East Jerusalem. And building the settlements in there, like in Beit Hanina, for example, they are expanding the settlement in Beit Hanina there. It doesn't leave any room for the Palestinian community there to expand anymore. Just need block it, either from the south by this block of settlement, from the north by a highway, a bypass road that they are doing.
In addition to its attempts to expand settlements in the Holy City and establish highways to link between the settlements inside Al-Quds and settlements outside it, Israel demolishes Palestinian homes under the claim they are built without Israeli-issued permits. Experts say Tel Aviv continues to establish more facts on the ground, designed toward a greater Jewish majority in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. aiming to create a new reality that makes realizing the two-state solution and Palestine's sovereignty over the city impossible.
What goes on in Jerusalem al-Quds amounts to silent eviction of the Palestinians. Israel plans to Judaize the city and conduct ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians. It aims to impose new identity on the city.
Palestinian officials had warned several days ago that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was planning to build thousands of settlement units for Orthodox Jews to encourage unity among religious Zionist parties before the Israeli elections that are set for March 23, especially that Netanyahu has no clear path to staying in power. Some might argue that Trump's so-called deal of the century is dead, but the reality on the ground is different, as Israel continuously approves construction of new settlements on occupied Palestinian territory. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The debate.
A group of 15 rights groups urged the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to address the deterioration of human rights in Bahrain. The group, which includes the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy and Amnesty International, wrote in a letter to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken that Bahrain's rulers were emboldened by President Trump, sending a clear message that his administration would place the pursuit of profit before people. Back in 2017, Trump said there won't be strain with this administration when it comes to U.S. Bahrain ties. Under Trump, Manama secured over $8.5 billion in arms deals. Bahrain has engaged in a widespread crackdown on opposition groups and human rights activists since 2011, when the country's rulers faced nationwide pro-democracy protests calling for the removal of the al-Khalifa regime.
More than a dozen rights groups have urged the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to restrict arms sales to Bahrain and address, quote, severe deterioration of human rights under the al-Khalifa regime. A letter signed by 15 groups, including the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, Amnesty International, and the World Organization Against Torture, has been sent to the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The letter calls on Washington to pressure Manama over his ban on opposition political parties and independent media, and demand an end to the suppression of activists, the use of torture, and other ill-treatment. It also urges the Biden administration to adopt a rights-based foreign policy toward Bahrain. The Bahraini regime has been cracking down on dissent since 2011 popular uprising against the al-Khalifa dynasty. Amid deafening silence of the then U.S. administration under Barack Obama and his successor Donald Trump, the kingdom went on with its heavy-handed tactic, killing and arresting activists and opposition figures. A recent report by a London-based Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy shows at least 51 people have been sentenced to death since 2011 in the tiny Persian Gulf island. Rights groups say Trump's public disdain for international human rights emboldened the al-Khalifa regime. They say Trump even sold $8.5 million worth of arms to Bahrain. The signatories of the letter have urged Biden to live up to his campaign promises of fighting for democracy and pressure Bahrain to introduce democratic reforms. The letter comes as the Biden administration is facing criticism for failing to hold Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman accountable for his role in the gruesome murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, that after a declassified U.S. intelligence report publicly accused bin Salman of approving Khashoggi's assassination in the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul in 2018. Washington's failure to take practical steps to bring bin Salman to justice once again exposes double standards in dealing with the criminals and rights abusers and its support for dictators. It also proved that the Biden administration's policies differ from those of Trump's only in rhetoric, not in essence. Ironically, such a stance under regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain would simply embolden them to carry on their grave violations of human rights at home and beyond their borders.
Joining us on this debate, we have former British ambassador to Bahrain, Mr. Peter Ford. Joining us from Manchester, also joining us on the line from London, we have Mr. Masoud Shajada from the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ford in Manchester. A group of 15 rights bodies has urged the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to address the deterioration of human rights in Bahrain. A part of the letter said that we hope that your administration will ensure that human rights are once again placed at the center of U.S. foreign policy in Bahrain, also calling for that in the wider Persian Gulf region. Share with us your thoughts on that letter.
Well, the initiative is well timed. It was just this week, a couple of days ago, that Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, made an important speech proclaiming that under Biden, America was going to be keen once more on spreading democracy and supporting human rights. Biden himself signed off on an important strategy document underlining that commitment. And here we have these 15 groups calling for America to put its money where its mouth is with regards to Bahrain, where the human rights situation is truly appalling, going from bad to worse.
Mr. Shajada, in London, the group wrote in the letter addressed to the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, that you noted that in too many countries, people are imprisoned and face torture or death for speaking their minds, reporting the news, or demanding their rights. This statement sadly reflects the situation in Bahrain over the last 4 years. Mr. Shajada, I think it's safe to say that it's not just the last 4 years in Bahrain, and it's not just in Bahrain, is it?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, we are. There is wanting articulation of supporting human rights and justice and democracy. We have heard this from the variety of administration from the United States, but in practice and in reality, definitely in the region of Middle East, and not just Middle East, we are seeing exactly opposite that. You know, we're seeing that dictators are being encouraged to continue their dictatorship and encouraged to implement these policies of barbaric policies of torture, imprisonment, and indeed they are continuously being supported. And, there is some people complain that this is double standard. But when you look at the whole history and the recent history, be it Obama's administration or Trump's administration or indeed the current administration, we are seeing this same situation. So it's not a double standard. Unfortunately, it's a one standard, which it's sort of legitimized hypocrisy and abuse and torture. You know, we just look at the Bahrainis cannot implement these policies without help and support directly from the West and United States. Even their torturers and the police and their army are being organized and sort of supported by indeed Americans and British ex-police officers, ex-MI5 officers, et cetera, et cetera. So really, I think it is very honorable for people to ask that, and it's the right thing to ask for, but I think we shouldn't be holding our breath.
Mr. Ford, under former President Trump, Bahrain secured over $8.5 billion in arms deals. The group of rights bodies said Bahrain's rulers were emboldened by President Trump, sending a clear message that his administration will place the pursuit of profit before people. Will it be any different now? Because that specific U.S. policy of having profit over people, it hardly ever changes.
Bahrain has taken out an insurance policy in the shape of normalizing relations with Israel. They know very well that the way to America's heart is through Israel, and that is precisely where they have gone. Last year, they moved quickly towards normalization, and every month almost brings a new development. Very recently, Crown Prince Salman invited Mr. Netanyahu to visit Bahrain. So just in case the arms purchases aren't enough to guarantee an American blind eye to human rights abuse, the Bahrainis have gone very deeply into a new relationship with Israel, including a security and intelligence relationship. They even have Israeli companies providing spyware to use against Bahraini citizens.
Mr. Shajareh, our guest in Manchester, he just mentioned the issue of Israel. As we know, Bahrain was among Arab nations that signed normalization agreements with the Israeli regime in 2020 during the Trump administration. Will Washington now want to get harsh with Manama after they've cozied up to the Israeli regime, surely agreeing to reap its benefits from Washington as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I have to point out that this cozy relationship has not been just come after so-called normalization. This has been going on for a very long time. All we saw it was the sort of public acknowledgement of this relationship. And indeed, I have to say that, you know, I agree with the other participants that it's not about the money. I mean, the amount of money that is being coming in through Bahrain or even Saudi Arabia, in the proportion to our GDP, in proportion of our export overall, it's really much less than even 0.something%. And so really that is not something that's breaking the deal. They're breaking the deal because they are actually doing the bidding of the United States and Israel, and they are oppressing their own people, they're torturing their own people, they're undermining their legitimate needs and aspirations. And as long as they are going to be sort of the agents of United States and Israel and so forth, and supporting and providing what they need to be provided in the region, it's very clear that they are being given sort of ability and the right to go and kill and torture their own people. And this is what is so sad. And, you know, this policy was the policy which was implemented elsewhere in the world. And this is a very short-sighted policy of trying to buy favor with the nation, because eventually people of Bahrain, like others, are going to sort of hold their leaders accountable. And then they're going to have a different view vis-a-vis United States or Israel and the West as a whole, who have been instrumental in the sort of denying them the empowerment of deciding their own future.
Mr. Ford, you mentioned the Bahrainis. They do have a sense of security right now by normalizing ties with Israel. There's another side to that security card as well, having in mind that Bahrain is home to the U.S.'s 5th Fleet. Do you think that regionally it's too far-fetched even to expect any major change in approach towards Manama, no matter who the president is?
I'm not at all optimistic for the reason you just cited, the presence of an important base for the Gulf base for the U.S. 5th Fleet. Bahrain, for many years, has been strategically important to the United States. Going forward, the U.S. strategists may realize that having ships so close to the Iranian coast is not really a good strategy, and what they consider assets are, in fact, liabilities, so that Manama could turn out to be a bit like Pearl Harbor if things got really, really bad. It's noteworthy that when things got very hot with Iran 18 months ago in the Gulf, the main U.S. Ships were withdrawn from the Gulf and parked 1,000 miles away. So the usefulness of that Bahraini base may have a sell-by date on it, but certainly for the duration of the Biden presidency, I'm afraid that consideration will weigh heavily with the Americans, and I don't expect the slightest real pressure to be put on Bahrain.
Mr. Shajara, the protests in Bahrain in 2011, they came amid similar uprisings in the region. There was Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Yemen. The U.S. and company, they went on to pick and choose who they supported and who they didn't. Back then, it was the Obama administration in office. Joe Biden was the vice president. That inconsistency and hypocrisy on the issue of human rights, it was even evident back then as well.
Absolutely. I think it really is extremely bad policy which United States is pursuing. As my colleague said, that you know, it really is the base is a liability, and I would say that even sort of these normalization and this sort of treatment of you know, being obedient servants of interests of the West and then oppressing your own people, it actually brings insecurity long term. If Bahrain indeed moved towards democracy at that time, when there was the sort of Arab Spring, or it would have actually ensured much more secure position. And the oppositions weren't asking for anything extreme. The opposition were extremely well organized. It wasn't like the situation that we have seen in Libya, where you know, the whole country was went into the turmoil. I really think that now what we could see, indeed, because of this policy that is being pursued by United States with the support of Israel and some other regional countries, indeed is going to bring instability. You can't sort of create a conflict or promote a conflict with Iran,
sure,
and certain parts of a region without bringing insecurity and instability to,
okay,
the whole region.
One last question from Mr. Ford. We have about 30 seconds left. Why has, in your opinion, the mainstream media kept silent on all that has happened in Bahrain? The crackdowns, the arrests, the death sentences, the stripping of citizenships. Very briefly, if you may.
Well, it's inconvenient and therefore is ignored. The mainstream media would much rather talk about Syria, for example, where, with regards to human rights, the situation is certainly no worse than it is in Bahrain. But Bahrain doesn't fit the narrative. No pressure is going to be put on Bahrain, and therefore Bahrain can get away with almost anything, which is tragic, because the people of Bahrain are very,
okay,
civilized, very sophisticated, and represent no threat to stability if they are allowed to
very
have
well
a say in.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Former British ambassador to Bahrain, Mr. Peter Ford, joining us from Manchester. Also, thanks to Masoud Shajareh from the Islamic Human Rights Commission joining us from London. Also, special thanks to you all for staying with us on this debate. It's a good night for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A fiery speech and last-ditch effort by Bernie Sanders to secure a place for a federal minimum wage hike in the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package appeared as good as doomed on Friday, 5th of March 2021, following a day that saw the flagship legislation hit grinding delays in the U.S. Senate. Senate leaders and moderate Democratic Senator Joe Manchin struck a deal late on Friday over emergency jobless benefits, breaking a nine-hour logjam that had stalled the bill. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Lauren Gambino and Joanne Grieve. The piece is titled, Sanders' Minimum Wage Effort Looks Doomed as COVID Bill Hits Roadblocks. Stay with us for more of Lauren Gambino and Joanne Grieve's article. Fiery speech and a last-ditch effort by Senator Bernie Sanders to secure a place for a federal minimum wage hike in the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package appeared as good as doomed on Friday, 5th of March, following a day that saw the flagship legislation hit grinding delays in the U.S. Senate. Senate leaders and moderate Democratic Senator Joe Manchin struck a deal late on Friday over emergency jobless benefits, breaking a nine-hour logjam that had stalled the bill. The compromise, announced by the West Virginia lawmaker and a Democratic aide, seemed to clear the way for the Senate to begin a climactic marathon series of votes and eventually approval of the sweeping legislation. The Senate next faced votes on a pile of amendments that were likely to last overnight, mostly on Republican proposals that are virtually certain to fail. More significantly, the jobless benefits agreement suggested it was just a matter of time until the Senate passes the bill. That would send it back to the House of Representatives, which was expected to give it final congressional approval before whisking it to President Biden for his signature. Progress on the bill slowed to a crawl on Friday afternoon, 5th of March, signaling that the legislation might not pass until the weekend, with Republicans still expected to introduce many amendments, all of which must see votes. Despite delays, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said the chamber would finish its work. The Senate is going to take a lot of votes, but we're going to power through and finish this bill however long it takes, Chuck Schumer said. The American people are counting on us, and our nation depends on it. If, as expected, the Senate passes the bill, it will then have to return to the democratically controlled House of Representatives for the final approval before being forwarded to President Biden. Earlier on Friday, Senator Bernie Sanders had, almost certainly in vain, implored Congress to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour within this piece of legislation, calling it disgraceful that lawmakers have allowed tens of millions of American workers to live on starvation wages. Nobody in America can live on $7.25 an hour, $9 or $12 an hour, Senator Sanders said. We need an economy in which all of our workers earn at least a living wage. A job in the United States of America should lift you out of poverty, not keep you in it. Last week, the Senate parliamentarian determined that a provision raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour was inadmissible under the rules of a special budgetary procedure Democrats are using to pass the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill on a party-line vote. Senator Bernie Sanders, backed by many progressives in the House, has called on Democrats to ignore the decision. During his remarks, Senator Sanders almost made a forceful case for enacting the relief bill, which is expected to pass with only Democratic support. This is a bill which will answer a profound question. Are we living in a democratic society where the U.S. Congress will respond to the needs of working families rather than just the wealthy and large corporations and their lobbyists, he said. Debate, voting on amendments, and backroom horse trading began in earnest on Friday, 5th of March, a day after the Vice President, Kamala Harris, broke a Senate tie to allow the chamber to take up the bill. Following Senator Sanders' speech, eight Democrats joined all Republicans to vote against the minimum wage proposal, suggesting that progressives vowing to continue the effort in coming months will face an uphill struggle. The eight Democratic senators who sided with the Republicans were Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire, Angus King of Maine, Kirsten Sinema of Arizona, Tom Carper of Delaware, Chris Coons of Delaware, Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire, and John Tester of Montana. Though Senator Sanders' amendment was poised for defeat, the vote remained open as Democrats scrambled to hammer out a deal on unemployment benefits. The version of the relief bill passed by the House provides $400 weekly emergency unemployment benefit on top of regular state payments through to August. But in a compromise with moderates revealed earlier on Friday, Senate Democrats said that would be reduced to $300 weekly, but extended until early October. The plan, sponsored by Senator Tom Carper of Delaware, would also reduce taxes on unemployment benefit by making $10,200 of individual benefits tax-exempt. The White House also said it supported the amendment. But by midday, lawmakers said Joe Manchin was ready to support a less generous Republican version. That led to hours of talks involving White House aides, top Senate Democrats, and Joe Manchin, as the party tried finding a way to salvage its unemployment aid package. The compromise announced on Friday night, 5th of March, would provide $300 weekly, with a final check paid on 6th of September, and includes the tax break on benefits. The day's lengthy standoff underscored the headaches confronting party leaders over the next 2 years, and the tensions between progressives and centrists as they try moving their agenda through the Congress with their slender majorities. With power in the Senate split 50-50 between the two political parties, just one Democratic defection is needed to block legislation or stall voting along the way if no Republicans cross the aisle. I feel bad for Joe Manchin. I hope the Geneva Convention applies to him, said the number two Senate Republican, John Thune of South Dakota, to reporters. The overall bill, aimed at battling the coronavirus and nursing the staggered economy back to health, will provide direct payments of up to $1,400 to most Americans. There is also money for COVID-19 vaccines and testing, aid to state and local government, help for schools and airline industry, tax breaks for lower earners and families with children, and subsidies for health insurance. Despite deep political polarization and staunch Republican opposition, the legislation has garnered broad public appeal. An opinion poll by Monmouth University found that 62% of the American public approve of the stimulus package, including more than 3 in 10 Republicans.
Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.